Thank you, Jeanette, for making math and science so cool and relatable. I can't do any of that, but that's awesome. So our in-person attendees here in the room, you are about to take off to check out our digital transformation showcase in another room. But for all of you who are watching online, we actually have some exclusive bonus content that we're going to show you. We're going to start that right now. Enjoy, and we'll see you in a bit.
Good morning from Redmond, Washington. I'm Grad Khan. I'm General Manager and CMO for Microsoft USA. And today I'm going to talk about the future of marketing. We're calling this session Marketing to the Future. So let's talk for a second about why everyone is so jazzed about marketing IT. And it's really quite an interesting look. If you take a look at the chart that's on the screen here, you can see that the overall global marketing industry is a $2.5 trillion industry, which is actually shockingly large. But what's more interesting is that if you were to look at global GDP, labor costs as a percentage of global GDP are about 20%. But you look at the marketing industry, of that $2.5 trillion, more than half, 51% of that $2.5 trillion is in labor costs, which means there is an amazing opportunity for IT to use AI, machine learning, and other technologies to enhance productivity and decision making and really take that 51% number and replace it with an IT spend. The other thing is in the media piece, which is about 22% of the total. The media piece is still a pretty big number with a lot of inefficiencies, and there are some pretty interesting opportunities to make some improvements there as well. And so, you know, let's talk a little bit about what's happening with the role of the CMO. The CMO today has got a job that's really quite different from the job 10 years ago. Deloitte's been doing a survey for the last 20 years. A decade ago, CMOs would have said their job was about brand awareness, about getting people to sort of visit their site. They would have sort of metrics around site visit, site awareness, length of time on site. There would be a whole bunch of things around how people were engaging with the brand, but relatively soft measures that could only be imputed as a driver of revenue. Today, CMOs actually have direct revenue responsibility. Two-thirds of CMOs say that revenue is either their first or second responsibility in their job. The result is that they need tools to be able to help meet those revenue targets. Otherwise, it's going to be really tricky keeping their job. So as a result, CMOs are involved in a lot of decisions around IT. And in fact, about 56% of the time, the CMO is part of the decision-making team on any IT investments that are made in an organization. And CMOs themselves will spend about $120 billion on IT by 2025. So it's a big number. Many CMOs didn't grow up in an IT infrastructure environment. They didn't get trained that way. They're not necessarily technologists. They're not necessarily engineers. And they're not necessarily really super crazy excited about this particular development, but they've got to do it because in order to be able to stay competitive, in order to be able to stay pace, in order to hit the revenue targets, they've got to make these kinds of investments. But it's really hard. This chart here is the Chief MarTech chart of all the logos of all the marketing point solutions that exist today. That number, 3874, is just continuing to rise. And so marketers are faced with this very confusing landscape of point solutions, many of them saying that they want to be platforms, sort of talking about sort of platform technology as being sort of the goal that they're going after, but obviously most of them won't be platforms, so how do you make choices? The result is that most marketers are actually not making choices. They're creating stack diagrams. The MarTech conference actually has a thing called the Stacky Award, which is, if you've got a better sign of dysfunction in an industry, I don't know what that would be. And look at the one we're sort of ending up on here. This is a prescription for insanity. We can't keep operating this way because if you look at this diagram with the 20 plus point solutions, you've got 20 plus databases, 20 plus UIs, 20 plus logins, and 20 plus customer IDs. And that's not a great way to drive a cohesive customer experience. We all know this. We're all aware of the issue. We're not sure what to do next. As a result, everybody is confused. All right, so now let me give you just sort of a sense of maybe why this isn't like the worst thing that's ever happened in the world, because it's not unnatural for a new industry to go through a period of massive explosion of brands and ideas and products, and then have that coalesce over time into a few well-understood platforms or products. And this has happened over and over again. Think about the PC industry in the 80s. Think about the consumer product good industry in the 1950s. At one point, there were more than 100 different detergents that you could buy. Today, there's really three or four, of which Tide is half of all of them. Think about the early days of railroads. There were tons of those. Radio, tons of radio manufacturers. The example I've got up here is the car industry. This is Bill Gates' favorite book. And why is that? It traces the evolution of the car industry. But when you read the book, it really, as you read it, think about how it maps against all those other industry examples I was giving you. It shows how industries start, how they don't have standards. For example, we didn't have a standard for gasoline. People would sometimes put gas in and blow their engine up. Other times they put gas in and the engine wouldn't start. We didn't have standards around tires, paint. There's tons of stuff. Roads. There were a million different things that there weren't standards around. Made it really hard. Plus, there were hundreds of car manufacturers. Just this little quick montage you're looking at right now are just examples of companies like Packard and Duesenberg. There were great car companies in their time. Some of them super famous. All of them gone. And ultimately, we ended up with the big three in Detroit. And so we're at that stage. We're at, say, probably the end of the beginning in marketing IT. We're at that sort of point of explosion where there's tons and tons of point solutions. And now we're about to figure out how to get those down to some core platforms and core functionality that allow us to do our jobs, hit our revenue targets, and provide an awesome customer experience for the customers that we're working with on a day-to-day basis. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about sort of how I've done that. I'm not going to pretend that I've got it perfect or that we've got it all worked out, because that's certainly a work in progress. But I am really proud of the work that we've done. I'm really proud of the journey we've gone on. And what I'm showing you here is about a six-year journey that we started way back in the 2011 to become modern marketers, but also to create a simplified stack that we could actually have a common customer interaction with. So what you're seeing here is this systems of nurture slide. This is actually, almost unbelievably, this took me about 5 years to draw. And I'm not sure if that just says something about me or if that says something about the complexity, but to simplify this to the point which is, hey, these are the five nurture stages we have. We're taking anonymous people, turning them into known leads or known prospects, taking those known prospects and nurturing them into marketing qualified leads, taking the marketing qualified leads and turning them into sales qualified leads, turning them into customers, and then obviously caring for those customers and reducing churn. That is the five stages of what we all do. Underlying all that is project management and BI and reporting. And you know, you've got to have systems that can sit across all five of those stages to be able to know how well you're doing and to be able to actually know that you've got the levers in place to hit the revenue targets that you've got. So customer experience management, or CXM. All right, so let's talk a little bit about how that's built. So it's obviously a set of clouds. So we're going to have an advertising cloud, marketing cloud, sales cloud, commerce cloud, and service cloud. The way that sort of my stack works, which is actually quite simple, is it's obviously based on Dynamics. That's our core business process application. I like using Dynamics because it's an awesome product and, you know, I get it for free. So two great benefits there. LinkedIn has now become part of the family. We'll get worked into Dynamics in really important ways. And there's a product called Follows. All these things are running on Azure. So we've got Azure as our core platform. We have a new, very significant partnership with Adobe. And Adobe sort of fills out that advertising cloud and marketing cloud piece, also running on Azure. And then we've got a long-term partnership with Sprinklr, another Azure ISV. And Sprinklr helps us manage customers from a social platform standpoint, both at the anonymous stage and the customer care stage. And don't forget Bing. Bing's a really important part of how we understand web data and how we target and talk to customers on the web. Underlying all that in the Insight Cloud and Planning Cloud, although you see the individual applications, it's basically Office 365. Those are all just components of Office 365. They're all fully integrated, and I can plan, measure, and look at my insights all in one set of dashboards. It's made it a lot easier to do my job because I can see this system end to end, and I've got a relatively integrated way of thinking about how people are moving through the different stages. I'm going to go into a little bit of detail for a second, just kind of how this all feels. So this is a snapshot of my Power BI dashboard, and you can see that the stages are across the top, just as we talked about a second ago. Known prospect, MAQL, or marketing qualified lead, through the telequalification stages and the sales qualification stages. And I can drill into that and get a lot of detail on what's happening. I have separately posted a demo of this. So if you are interested in seeing more, there is a demo in the Wonderful World of Marketing videos that I do. It gives you a 15-minute deep dive on how this marketing dashboard works. And there is a modern marketing dashboard solution that we can connect you with and give you the recipe for how to put it together. The other thing was really important as we went through each of these stages is to really understand the KPIs. And so the KPIs in demand generation, relatively well known, but defined. We've added a bunch of new stuff, obviously, in the Adobe partnership in terms of how they're profiling our customers. In the Marketing Cloud, the KPIs were based on marketing qualified leads and the quality of those MQLs, you know, making sure that they're converting at an appropriate rate. In the Sales Cloud, not surprisingly, it's win revenue with KPIs around the marketing funnel and SQLs and what our win conversion rates are like. In the Commerce Cloud, again, you know, we actually have our own commerce systems, but we're looking at basket to buy conversion rates and the revenue we're generating from that. And then the Service Cloud, you know, how are we doing with our customers? Are we keeping them happy? Is the Net Promoter Score high? What is the time on call for customer care, and how are we making sure we keep satisfaction really high? And sort of defining those KPIs up front is a really critical part of how you need to make sure that you've set up your Power BI dashboards in a way that you know whether you're succeeding or failing and can sort of self-correct over time. So let me kind of talk a little bit about the future. So I'm going to sort of switch gears now, and that's sort of where I am today. The future is really exciting, and there's going to be a lot of changes coming with the impact of AI. So if we think about our sort of systems of nurture, I want to talk a little bit about ID. You know, ID is something where we may have an advantage in the marketing industry that they didn't have in manufacturing. One of the challenges in manufacturing ERP systems is that when you sort of choose a product ID system, you're effectively committing to vendor lock-in, which tends to keep the progress of an industry a little bit behind because clients tend to resist vendor lock-in. But we may have an industry standard that we can use, especially around companies. And around companies, there's something called the DUNS number. And there are 250 million companies with the DUNS number. And Dun & Bradstreet provides that service, and we could actually use that as an industry. There are about 12 other kind of core data packets that Dun & Bradstreet appends to that DUNS number. So this sort of value of 13 elements could be a really interesting way for all of us to have similar systems and similar ID. So that's something I'm kind of encouraging people to think about. So once we have that ID, what do we do with it? Now, the one sort of observation I'll make about marketing and marketing AI is that we have traditionally in marketing looked at the interactions people have had with us in the marketing realm, which when you think about it is a pretty narrow siloed view of the customer. Because that customer's got a lot of other things that they're doing, and there's a lot of other characteristics about the customer that are important to us understanding whether that customer would want to make a sale with us, want to have a relationship with us, and want to be part of our family. And so, for example, do they own shares in Microsoft? That would give me a very interesting sense of their propensity to buy. Are they an Xbox Live user? I like to know that. That's not something we typically pull into existing marketing systems, but AI can do that. And we've got this running in Microsoft Research right now. Now, what's really cool is looking at the whole person allows us to have a much more comprehensive view of what that person is really interested in and make sure that we provide the right product messaging to them in a way that they would appreciate. People typically hate advertising when it's irrelevant. But if you actually know what someone's trying to discover, what someone's trying to find out, and if you can actually get that to them at the right moment, it's highly appreciated. And so AI holds the promise of being able to look at a variety of factors and make up the whole person and be able to have a really comprehensive discussion with them. We call it the interaction cloud. And the interaction cloud really is all the interactions across both marketing and any other connections that they have with the company, including something like a customer care incident. Let me show you how it might work. So, you know, this is a sales bot, and it goes, you know, kind of, hi, can I help you? And so, and it's identified as a bot. And this would be an interaction that a seller working for Microsoft would be having with a bot. And think of this as a replacement for a CRM system. And it's still in CRM, but think of this as a CRM interface that's radically different from the CRM interfaces we have today. And so, in very natural language, the seller could either dictate or type in, you know, what accounts have I not spoken to? The bot does a quick analysis, and here's an account list you've not interacted with. Then our seller can just say, great, who's the VP? Here's the VP. Would you like to have set up a LinkedIn meeting? And right in line, yep, absolutely, I would like to set up a LinkedIn meeting. And then it's being, the request is being sent to the customer on behalf of the seller, all just through the bot interaction. And hey, by the way, looks like a customer of yours has had some interaction with marketing materials. Here's their number, and would you like to set up an appointment? And then the sales bot sends an appointment. I love where we're going in interface design and computing. As our computers get more powerful, we're finally able to be more human again. As opposed to conforming to the machine, which is really effectively what the keyboard is, the machine is now starting to conform to us. It can take verbal input, our gaze, gesture, all these kinds of things are becoming a much more commonplace. And it's a very exciting time because humans are going to be able to interact with machines the way we can interact with each other. So I'm going to wrap for today. One thing I want to leave you with is that I love talking to customers and I love interacting with customers. So feel free to reach out and connect with me. You can send me an email. You can follow me on Twitter and you can DM me there. You can connect with me on LinkedIn. You can become my friend on Facebook. Or you can read my blog, and I post something roughly every day. Have a great conference, enjoy the rest of the time, and I'll see you later.
Hello, everyone. By now, many of you have probably heard of Bitcoin, the virtual currency that began making headlines about a decade ago. And now, the larger concept of blockchains is showing potential for becoming a major disruptor to the way all of us do business. Here to share some actionable insights about it with us is an expert on the subject. Jeremy Epstein is the CEO of Never Stop Marketing, a leading advisor on blockchain-based solutions. Jeremy joins us via Skype from Washington, D.C. Hi, Jeremy.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Jeremy, for those who are not familiar with this term, what is a blockchain?
Sure, great question. So blockchain at its core is a distributed ledger, a copy, a big giant spreadsheet that everyone has a copy of, if you will, and it maintains a historical record of all the transactions. What's unique about it is all of these transactions are cryptographically secured and then linked to each other in a chain, hence the term blockchain, with the previous ones, which makes it near impossible to rewrite history. So this list of transactions, which sort of represents, you know, the chain of ownership or chain of custody, is also open to anyone and verifiable. And finally, each item in the database or each item in the ledger is actually has a clear owner, and that ownership can be transferred. Only transferred by the individual. So the security of the network is guaranteed not by an individual or a company, but by the entire network. So at a high level, it's a distributed database, and it's got a couple interesting attributes to go along with it. Hopefully that helps.
That helps. Thanks for that explanation. So why do you believe that blockchain is not just a passing fad? Why is it important to know about right now?
Yeah, great question. As a technology marketer, I know that every week there's a new like, hey, this is going to change the world type of thing. So we're all sort of like, okay, you know, boy who cried wolf scenario, and we get used to, you know, passing it off. But what's fascinating about blockchain is that for the first time ever, 9 years ago, when the Bitcoin blockchain was introduced, they solved one of the most vexing problems of the digital age, which is known as the double spend problem. You see, if I take a picture of my kids, who aren't going to walk in right now, I hope, and I send it to somebody, I have a copy of the picture and my friend has a copy of the picture. Not a problem. But what about value? I can't take a picture of a $20 bill and send it to you because I still have the $20 bill, and pretty soon the economy falls apart. So we've historically relied on third-party intermediaries, banks, you know, brokerage houses, to make sure that, yes, Jeremy no longer has the money and Alice now has the money, what have you. What the blockchain represents is the solution to the double spend problem by securely and with everyone knowing, moving the ownership of an asset from person A to person B without the need of a centralized intermediary. So number one is it's already working and it's been working for 9 years, never been hacked, never taken down. So you look at this and you look at the potential and you look at the fact that we now have a global network of, you know, 2 billion people connected to the internet, 5 billion devices, mobile devices, fast broadband in most of the developed world for sure. And all of a sudden you start saying, wow, this can actually work at global scale. So it's pretty dramatic. I get pretty excited about it. So pardon me, I'm not, you know, and the coffee's kicking in. But, you know, it represents a huge sea change in the way we've historically done business. And you can start seeing all types of potentials down the road. And it has a ginormous disruptive possibility. Huge.
I can feel your excitement about this. And this is an obvious question for you, but I do want to know how significant you think this is going to be in terms of the future implications for businesses and also for society.
Well, at the risk of being, you know, part of the hype cycle or what have you, it's hard for me to understate what I think the implications are going to be. Because, you know, I'm in my mid-40s now, and you remember what life was like before the sort of internet, when the internet kind of took off, just with information. And now we think about how quickly information moves around. But the transference of value hasn't really kept pace. I mean, you and I can send pictures and files or whatever anywhere on the planet in a second or two. But if you want to sell your car or your house or probate a will or any of those things, those still take days, weeks, months, even like an ACH transfer still takes 3 to 5 business days. That's absurd. So, and think about how much of our business, our lives depend on moving value around everything. So all of those sort of repercussions that we've seen from just information being kind of freed up and liberated and democratized. Now think about the exponentially huge impact of what happens when value gets liberated from these slow, outdated, you know, pre-digital era processes. It's, you know, I feel like it's a tsunami 50 miles off the coast and almost very few people actually know it's coming. That's how big I feel like it is.
So let's talk about sort of the application of this concept. Is it just a fantasy at this time, or do you think it's actually working anywhere in the world? And can you give us some examples?
So I don't think it's actually working. I know it's actually working. It's working in multiple locations. So first of all, you know, the Bitcoin blockchain. So let me take a step back. Just like email is an application that runs on the internet, Bitcoin is an application that runs on a blockchain. So you'll have many, many different applications that run on blockchains. So for example, in the insurance industry, where 30% of your premiums go to just overhead, it's ripe for disintermediation. There's a company called Lemonade. They paid an insurance claim a few weeks ago in 3 seconds. Right. It takes me 3 seconds to find the 800 number to call. You know, it's crazy. There's a company called Ripple. They do interbank payments, you know, multinational settlements. They sent money from Canada to Germany in 8 seconds. You know, Everledger has an entire blockchain just to track the provenance of diamonds because you want to make sure the diamond you're getting is not a blood diamond or a conflict diamond. You want to make sure that it wasn't stolen. It's not counterfeit. You know, Walmart's beginning a supply chain project in China to track pork provenance because not every farm in China, for example, has the highest health standards. The Republic of Georgia and the country of Sweden are both putting their land registries on blockchain. And the DTCC, which is the central clearinghouse that settles over $11 trillion worth of trades every year, actually, they've announced they're moving to blockchain. So there are already things that are in production, and there are a lot more that are coming. So it's already working, and you're seeing this growth in pretty much every single industry where there's a third-party intermediary, which is another way of saying every industry.
So what do you think our audience members should do today to start getting ready for a blockchain world?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I mean, I think there are a couple things that they could do. And it's, I sort of borrowed a phrase from a friend of mine called future back thinking. So when you think about blockchains, there are a couple implications. Number one is data gets liberated from silos and it's shared globally. So now you have this global shared data layer that everybody has access to. Well, if your data is not proprietary and it's available to everybody, how does your business need to evolve in that respect? Number two is like trust. Right now we pay a trust tax. If I want to send money to another country, you know, Western Union, I have to pay them, you know, 10, 12, 13% or whatever to do that because they're serving as that trusted intermediary. What if you don't have those intermediaries and you don't pay a trust tax? What if every asset has a digital token that's associated with where you can prove beyond any shadow of a doubt that you actually own that asset? So now, you know, the painting in your house or the autograph of, you know, from Magic Johnson, you can prove this is the real deal. And it's a thing on your phone, which you can just send to somebody else. And you have the ownership of that thing. What if one sexy area is there's a whole area of developing called smart contracts. So if you think about any business transaction, there's a series of legal and business rules that surround that transaction. But what's a contract? It's basically a series of if-then statements. If I show up for this event, then they'll pay me. If I do this work, then you get paid, whatever it is. That's all software code is. So now, by digitizing all these assets, you're going to be able to assign business and legal rules directly to it, which potentially disintermediates and eliminates the need for a whole series of lawyers, accounts payable, account receivables. So I think you need to think about how these back office functions will be done. Supply chain is another one. You know, how do you make sure that you can prove that you're not just making things up, and in fact, there's you know, that the claims that you're making can be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. So I would challenge people, you know, to take a day or two, take an insurance policy out on themselves, their future careers and their companies, and say, what if these blockchains become omnipresent? What if these things become the givens the way that 25 years ago we couldn't foresee the internet, but now it's here? What if that's the reality? Well, how would our business add value? How would we serve our customers? What would our supply chain look like? So I think there's a whole series of workshops and questions you can ask yourself to start thinking about this and potentially, hopefully get ready so you don't, you know, find yourself on the wrong end of what I think is obviously a huge wave.
Well, what do you think are the consequences, Jeremy, of not getting on board or not considering blockchain?
Yeah, you know, having been through these, that's a great question. Having been through these cycles a few times now, like, I definitely am a little bit nervous about preaching the fire and brimstone scenario because I know how easy it is to kind of say, oh, this guy's a total lunatic, which happens to me a lot.
Because, no, sure it doesn't.
Yeah, sometimes. But I think, like, look, the case I want to make to people is that this is the real deal. It's already working. You know, the pace of life today requires that the value transfer needs to catch up to the information transfer. And when you look down the road at the whole Internet of Things, like, that can only work at the scale we're going to have in a blockchain world. So I think the case I'm going to make is this is the real deal and you should take it seriously. And hopefully, you know, I'm right and you agree with my conclusion. And if you know, if I'm wrong, okay, you spend a couple days. But if I'm right and you don't spend the time, sort of many people like me are right and you don't take the time, I think you're going to have a really difficult time because, like I said, any business that relies on being that trusted intermediary, they're in the crosshairs of this wave of disruption. Anybody who is just sort of working around the periphery around transactions, they're going to be definitely, you know, challenged to add value if they keep doing what they're doing. I'll give you one quick example and then I'll shut up. You know, a friend of mine just came to me and he was so proud and he said his son just graduated from college and got a job as an internal auditor at one of the big accounting firms. And I sat there and I didn't have the heart to say anything, but I'm thinking, okay, this stuff's not going to be here tomorrow. It's not going to be here next week, but it's going to be here in a couple of years where you don't need internal auditors. The job function just doesn't exist. So I hope this kid is smart enough to kind of see that change coming and realize that's not going to be a job. Just like 100 years ago, you didn't need, you know, buggy makers and horseshoe people anymore. That's the kind of thing. So you have to start looking which jobs are going to get removed, and then where's the new value getting created. So, you know, if you buy the argument that this change is coming, I hope you adapt. And if you don't buy it, you know, best of luck.
Jeremy, you make a strong case. Thank you so much for participating in the CXO Summit.
Thanks for having me.
You've been watching an insightful conversation on blockchain with Jeremy Epstein. And now back to your live streaming coverage of the CXO Summit.